Welcome back to another episode of Life with Your Dog. My name's Panos, joined by my good brother, Luke Badman. How are you?
Good morning.
I love seeing Mr. Panos, the upcoming author. Yes, well, I guess we can start whispering a little bit louder now, yeah. Since that it's a little bit more official, but my final manuscript for the book has been completed, and now it's in the hands of an editor, and should be fixing that and doing everything that needs to make it look and sound awesome.
How does it feel to have got that off your plate a little bit?
Massive relief on one end, and then also a little bit overwhelming on the other.
Yeah.
Since now I have to do all the things that a publisher would do, because we'll be putting self-publishing that on Amazon. So
yeah.
I hope all of our listeners here support and
I'm going to get myself a hard copy.
Nice, let's do it.
I'm going to have you sign it for me.
And we're going to have to do a book signing somewhere, you know.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, get all the dogs out and the people. It's going to be cool. So I guess we can start talking about it now. I don't have a name, but I'm probably going to use the audience maybe on my Instagram to kind of help me.
Yeah, workshop the name.
Yeah, yep. I'll come down, because the name that I had, my editor didn't really fully like. It was a little bit too long probably. So
okay. Needs to be like punchy, I guess.
It has to be punchy, and I want it to be, you know, original, but also, you know, something to do with what's actually happening. So that's all right. We'll work on that. And there's a few other things, like heaps of other stuff that needs to be done, but it's all exciting. The project will be finally coming to an end. So
awesome, brother.
It does feel good. It's hard as well when you start getting towards the end of a project and, you know, new things that you've never done before have to be done. So you can't, like, there's a bit of like this natural, like the brakes are being put on. Mm. You're like, oh, I don't know. And also, how do you find, like, for example, if you're looking for a dog trainer and you just Google search, you're like, oh, I don't know, like, I'll call this guy and hope he's not lying and hope their marketing isn't outshining their ability, you know? So you want like a good referral, you want word of mouth. And I did come in contact with Shannon through word of mouth of someone who's already published their book about 5 years ago and used her. So that's always a good relief too. At least somebody that I know has used her and found success. And I think that's really important. You know, the power of word of mouth is
100%.
Is the best. So let's get it done. But today's episode, we're going to talk about the 6 stages of prey/play drive. So we'll just have a little definition of what is prey drive. So prey drive is predatory drive. It's the instinctive drive that a dog has to hunt, to eat, and live.
Are you telling me that my dog is a predatory animal?
Can you believe it? Those canines aren't there for no reason.
Mm.
I don't know
if that fits with my worldview.
Well, look at the facts, Luke. So it's important that we understand. We even acknowledge that there are 6 stages of prey drive. Prey drive isn't just the fact that you're just chasing an animal. It goes through the whole, from the beginning to the end. So the six stages is the stalk, then you have the chase, the strike, the fight, the parade, and the consume. Mm. So we'll start with the stalk, obviously. So just so we all know, and we can put this out there, is that every time you throw that ball or you play tug, you are stimulating prey drive in your dog. Your dog is hunting when you throw that ball. The ball goes flying down the park.
That's why he likes it so much.
Loves it, right?
Yeah.
He's like obsessed by it. Actually, I put a story up the other day. I'm like, I can't believe Chili's not over this ball already. You just throw it every day. Oh, we throw it. It's kind of exciting to see it. It's also, on one level, is there like form of stress? The fact that you're chasing a thing, you grab it, but there is no end result. I don't think there is. I'm just thinking out loud, is that, you know, all of our dogs were designed to do a particular job, a task, and have some sort of purpose. And now that we don't have that typically, because we don't live agriculturally or hunter gathering, we have our dogs, what we need to do is, you know, fulfill them and give them biological stimulation. So when you want to find the closest surrogate to the activity your dog was meant to do. So for our dogs, they're sheep dogs, they're herding dogs. So the best thing to give them is sheep and give them a job to herd. And if you had sheep and a dog, then you want to move them from paddock to paddock so you can look after the land and all that. So like there's an outcome to it. And maybe the closest surrogate to a sheep dog would be to herd like those big herding balls. And if you were going to do that, because a lot of people, I've gone to a lot of clients' houses and they have those herding balls, but still not used correctly, in my opinion, is that the dog goes out, sees the ball, gets all mad at Mentor, and just runs around the backyard with it. And I know there's a sense of you know, chasing and herding.
Mm.
But when I said, like in the last example when I saw it with a cattle dog, I said, yeah, but what's the outcome? Like your dog's gone all jacked up, runs up to the ball, runs around in circles. Is the outcome for him to bring the ball back to you? Do you want to make him move the ball to somewhere else? Do you want him to like hold the ball in one spot? Like,
yeah, what's your intention?
Yeah, like what are we doing? Otherwise, the dog goes out, goes mental, runs around in circles, gets all crazy, but there's no outcome. So I think that kind of causes a little bit of, you know, underlying confusion or stress in a way. And maybe not confusion, stress, but jacked up, over aroused, and we get other behaviors coming from the excessive barking,
yep.
You know, and then obsessive behaviors where the dog just sees the ball as the thing. Or another thing that I'm not excited about is, so group class the other day when it was like, oh, we're going to like, you know, working with the ball, how we work with play, how do we use the ball to reward behaviors? And one of my clients was using their squeaky ball and squeaking it to get the dog's attention. And I'm like, and that obviously in the group setting is distracting. So now the whole lot of dogs are like, what the hell's happening? There's a squeaky toy. Now I should probably clarify it because the squeaky toy is part of the six stages of prey drive. Because when a dog is squeaking a squeaker, that squeak is representing and sounds and feels like a little tiny dying animal. So if you were to get
which
a little
is
tiny-
the kill?
Which is, well, there is no kill in here. So stalk, chase, strike, fight, parade, and consume. So wait, I would say,
oh, okay, yeah,
I'd say it would be part of the fight, and maybe potentially part of the consume, and then it'll be part of the parade because most of the times the dogs get the ball, the squeaker in the mouth, and they run around in circles squeaking it.
Yes.
So it's probably triggering those three. Those last three parts of it. So the squeaker is squeak, squeak, squeak. Rah, rah, rah. You grab a little duck, try to go grab, snap its neck. It's probably going to make that noise before it dies. And usually once a squeak is dead in the toy, a lot of the times the dog just leaves the whole toy alone.
Yeah.
He's like, I've killed it now. So now some dogs will go back and then continue to de-stuff the toy and, you know, and some other dogs will go and consume it and actually eat it.
Yeah.
Like my little Nookie, if I don't come and pick up all the remnants from when Chili's destroyed something, it's likely that sometimes she will swallow something. She's been a lot better recently, but she's a bit of an idiot like that. So when we're
we
in
love
class,
you, Nookie.
Yeah, Nookie's the best. So she needs a haircut. She looks ridiculous. So so Bill had the ball and he's like, squeak, squeak, to get Rambo's attention. Rambo's like, whoa, I'm into it. And then he would like tell the dog to sit and then throw it. So what I don't like is that we use that squeak to stimulate the dog. What we want to do is we want the again, it's not like it's a bad thing, but it can over arouse them. It's like you squeak it and the dog starts losing their mind. Then you ask them to hold their down. It may be harder for them to do that. So in the early stages, well, actually, in fact, anytime I train with a dog, I don't use anything that squeaks or makes noise because I don't want another reason as well is especially when the dog grabs the toy is that they start chewing on it and it starts squeaking. And then now they're getting the value there, not coming from me. So it could be like, I've given you the toy, you squeak it all you want until it dies in the backyard. That's a you and the toy game. That's a one player game. But when I'm playing with you, I don't want you to, I don't want the dog to be squeaking the toy away from me, getting good feelings there and not getting the good feelings at me. So, because the dog would just grab the ball and just go, this is heaps better to squeak it and kill it. I'll go neck under the tree and do it there. So I do use like the little tiny Kong balls for Nookie, I just get a knife and I just slit her through and kill the squeak so that I can throw it and she doesn't squeak it. And I just find it annoying that it squeaks.
Is that because she'll just do it relentlessly?
Not too bad. Like she's not too bad with it, but I don't want it to that when she, sometimes when she'll bite it, she's like, and then she'll get all crazy. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
I just wanted to think, once you've caught the ball, nothing happens. Retrieve it back to me and then it turns on again.
The ball itself has no inherent value. It's only in you bringing it back and we restart the game.
Yeah. Except for the toys in the yard, I don't throw for my dog. So then they get the value of squeaking it on their own.
Yeah.
They get their own value. So I don't take it away from the dog as if they shouldn't get it. It's just it doesn't come through the game because then too much self-reinforcement for behaviors I don't really necessarily want away from me. And with Chili, he'd probably squeak the shit out of it. Ages. So and then also you can see like when they start squeaking, their eyes start to dilate and they get really big and they get all like shaky and like whoa, like and then
round
it becomes
up,
it becomes a whole different thing.
Dopamine
Massive dopamine dump for sure.
What am I trying to say? All wound up over the ball. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So when you throw that ball, your dog's chasing. And then when you are playing tug, your dog is fighting, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're also working on the strike there too. So playing these games will fulfill those instinctive drives. So when we'll go from the beginning and we'll talk about the stalk. Now, not every time you see a dog stalking, they are in prey drive, because I think sometimes they will stalk if they feel that, like, there's a threatening situation around. But we'll just talk about stalk. Like, we're walking down the street, we got a border collie, because border collies love to stalk, and they see a bird. And then we're walking normally, they see the bird, and then boom, they go into prey locking. So their eyes just stare in, their ears point forward, their tail goes up, they go real slow. One of their legs kind of rise up like a pointer. They kind of wait. And then in that moment, they wait for their right time. As soon as the bird, like, you know, looks away or goes to, like, eat something from the ground, boom, the dog will then go into that chase. So the stalk is a real... And what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about the sixth stage, but how do we hack it so it can make our game better?
Mm.
So a lot of times people think playing the ball and playing tug is just playing tug. But sometimes you need to, depending on the dog and depending on, and it was very interesting. I was listening to a podcast. Cameron Ford was hosting Michael Ellis and Ivan Belabanov on the podcast. And they were talking about some dogs. What was it? They were saying something about, like, some dogs won't play with the ball, or if they do play with the ball, they don't find the interest in it, because I think each dog has a different expression, and depending on how you try to get them engaged in the game. So I'll give you a more practical example. So another example from group class the other day, little Rupert, little Staffy Cross, they had the ball on the rope and they were like throwing the ball, but the dog was like, meh. Like, looking everywhere else and not really interested. So as I grabbed the ball, I kind of triggered a bit of that stalk. So what I did was I had the ball, I'm like, whoa, whoa. I'd like kind of like fake throw, like half throw it, but bring it back to me. He was like, is it going? Is it staying? And there was a moment where he kind of locked into it. He locked into it, sits, boom, and I mark and throw. So I capture some of that stalk. And then he kind of gets into the zone going, oh, my, where is it going? Where a lot of the times the ball is dead on the end of the rope. People are like just wiggling it around like erratically. A dog can't catch that. If it's erratically moving up and down and back and forth, how is the dog going to like target it and hit it without biting your hand? And if you do that too often, the dog's like, this is a stupid, impossible game. I'm not going to get much out of it. I'm going to go and sniff the ground over there. So, or if you have a real serious dog that has heaps of prey drive, there's no not getting the dog to bite it, but then he's, as I said before, he's missing it, he's hitting you, he's biting the rope. So with the stalk there, I was able to just try to build some of that intention and that intensity towards the focal point of the ball. Not all the time that I actually, I'm pretty sure the first couple of times I just marked and threw the ball. But then once I, like, so then he got the ball, we played a bit of tug. I told him to drop it. He knows the drop command. And I told him to sit. And then in that moment of sitting, he's like, his whole jaw and his head was like, like chewing. Like, he was like jacked up. And I jacked him up from being more animated, becoming a bit of an actor and showing that this ball is the thing that you want to catch. And he's like, where is it? And he's looking at it. And he's like, I want to catch it. Where a lot of times, we've said this many times on the podcast, there is no suicidal rabbits. You don't shove a tug or a ball into the dog's mouth. That's not fulfilling for the dog. You need it to move away from them. The more you move it away, the more he will pursue and chase. And just like yesterday when we were throwing the ball for another little Staffy Cross, and he had the ball and he was chewing it on his own, but his owner kept walking to him to get the ball. And every time she went to him, he would run away. So what I did was when I threw it, I had the dog on the long lead. And then I'm like, oh, get the ball. And he'll grab the ball. And as soon as he grabbed the ball, I moved backwards, moved away from him. And then he brings it closer to me. And then I played the game. So we want to make sure that in the stalk, is when the thing is away and the dog thinks that he's not being seen, and the stimulus, the prey, doesn't go close to him. Typically, it goes away from him.
Mm, yeah.
Like, and if it goes a little bit closer to him and it's like taking away his vantage point, the dog will like move around a tree or in a different direction and stalk. So, capturing some of that stalk, and I think Ivan in that podcast was giving the example of if you're going to be training with like a pointer, the pointer typically isn't really a retriever dog, but you can get them to be more into the game if you can tap into some of their stalk. And the point of the pointer is, the point of the pointer is for them to point. So you walk down the into the forest, they pick up a whiff or a visual of a deer and they just go like a statue. And they're just stalking. And then that becomes indication, to my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, anyone out there, is that now when the dog now points, I'm assuming now the deer hunter shoots a deer, and then now we harvest the deer. Otherwise, maybe you could use it for other situations where pointer points, and then now you have other dogs that actually hunt the animal, then you can let go of the other dogs to go and actually grab and catch the pig. So with every one of these stages, there are different breeds that have a different predisposition to be more stronger in one than the other. Some dogs, like a pity, probably don't stalk very long. They see and run. They see, run, chase, strike, and fight. And then boom, that's where their strong point is. Where this is not my place of expertise. So I know that some people do go pig hunting and they have their pigging dogs, whether it's a pity or a staffy, like a pity or like a mastiff or like a bull Arab, but they have their kelpies to find and locate and almost probably, I'm assuming, herd the animal to kind of keep it within the range of the other dogs that come. So every dog, but from what I've heard, the kelpies aren't really hanging on and holding that pig down. Maybe they are doing something, but it's the other bigger, larger mastiff bully breeds are holding that pig down for the hunter to come and then make that kill. So again, it's quite graphic. I'm sorry. It is what it is, but we're talking about hunting nature and fighting and consuming. This is just what it is. And if you want to turn a blind eye to this, then you're just being ignorant to the fact that your dog wants to kill things. And metaphorically as well as literally. Yeah, he's a predator, right? So with us, we have this high desire to watch balls run around a field and then throw them at trajectories so we can make a victory towards another team. And it's usually a very physical pursuit. It sounds very much like hunting and tribal warfare to me. It hasn't gone very far from our genetics. So we have that. That's why we have this desire to crush business, to get out there, to be ambitious. Where if we'll prey animals, I would say we would spend a lot of time moseying around and not making civilization, I don't think.
Not real much.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Who knows?
Yeah.
And I know we're omnivore, we're not carnivore, but I'm sure dogs are omnivore too, so they can eat vegetable matter. They, like, you know, they don't, and this is going to further my point, like they don't need meat to survive, even though they will never thrive off not eating meat. Like a dog shouldn't, in my opinion, be vegan, right? When I went to a client's house, because of their worldviews, they were hardcore vegans, and now they made the dog vegan by giving him this vegan kind of kibble. And I'm pretty sure we've discussed this long time ago with, I think, with Narelle, the nutritionist, when she was on the podcast. But when I did reach out to her,
there's a company making that, is there?
Company makes vegan dog food. Can you believe it? Anyway, so I'm there and I'm very stumped and I'm very confused and I didn't want to be rude and too intense, but I needed to make my point and to show them where I stood on the matter. And I said to him, look, are you vegan because of a health choice or because of a animal justice choice? And they said it was because animal justice in cruelty to animals. Okay, I'm like, all right. So now we're going ideologically, not really biologically. It's not like saying I do this because I don't think we should eat meat. I'm saying we shouldn't eat meat because we shouldn't kill animals. And it not that one's right or wrong, like, you know, I don't want to be like pushing too much of my own opinion there, but I think that they're both wrong. But in saying that, now you're pushing your ideology onto an animal that has no say. Yeah. And I'm like, and he's a staffy cross. He's got canines. I've lifted his lips up and you can see his canines. The canines were there so he can sink those things into another animal so he can eat them. So anyway, I'm like, look, I can't make you do anything and I want to help you. So let's do what we need to do. So they gave me their ridiculous coconut flaked paprika treats. And she said I could even eat them because they were like, you know, they made them that morning and I ate it and it was actually pretty tasty. And the dog loved it because he's probably starving. But regardless, I said to him, look, if you're going to do this once a month, I need you to go to the vet and do a blood test. If you're going to do that, I would say blood testing for the first 12 months of you doing this to make sure that he's not deficient
yeah.
and he's not getting sick and stuff. And they were actually doing that, and they weren't bad people. I think they did mean well. I did get some, I haven't named any names now, so I did get some intel from the last session where the husband or boyfriend, it was just me and him, and he's like, yeah, man, I secretly eat chicken nuggets, and he just tells me, he's like, he was just confessing all of his sins to me about his being forced, I guess, to be vegan.
As long as everyone thinks that you're a vegan, I guess.
Yeah, isn't that funny, right? But then actually that training session, he's like, hey, how about we give him the treats that you got? And I had the Prime 100 and I gave it to him, and the dog was like salivating and freaking out. So look, it is what it is. And when I spoke to Narelle, she says, look, depending on the diet that the dog's on, they can survive, but your dog will never be able to thrive on a vegan diet. Anyway, so that's, and look, and imagine trying to execute any of the six stages of prey drive to vegetables. Like, you're going to stalk and chase and strike and fight and parade with pumpkin. Probably not. You can consume it, and that's only the last stage, which again, in this six stages here, technically then, when you give your dog food, that food drive is the last stage of prey drive. So typically every reward you give your dog, besides a pat or access to something, to a coming inside, if it's a ball, the tug or food, it's all triggering some sort of prey drive.
Savage beast.
The beast. So the stalk is there to identify where your target is, to assess, to be still and to be stiff and to be focused, hella focused, before boom, explosion into the chase. So can you stimulate some of that stalk and use it for what you're trying to do? Are you trying to get more engagement in the game? Are you trying to get more intensity? Are you trying to make the reward? You could tell your dog to down, to recall, and then reward. And then just before you reward, like, hold it, and then throw it. Just kind of capture some of that, like, well, what are we doing here? We're just throwing it may not be enough for a dog. And maybe too much stalking makes your dog go way too into prey drive, where he gets too aroused, rather, and then it's harder for him to be focused. So a lot of the things that we need to do here, we don't want to suppress any of their drive. Sometimes you may need to, but our job here is to cap it. The best thing is to cap drive, not suppress it. So like, my dog wants to chase lots of different things. Even though I've told him he's not allowed to chase certain things, I cap it so that I can still use it when I need it. I don't want to get rid of it. And I think it's a sad fact. And I'm pretty sure we spoke about this last episode, talking about the use of behavioral medication being so prevalently used.
Just squash means the dog.
They're just squashing their drives. It's not doing anything. If you want to be really training and using behavior, you want to fulfill these. So the chase, I guess I don't have to speak too much about the chase. It's pretty obvious. Everyone knows what chasing means. Dog runs after the thing, and while in the chase, he is in that second stage of prey drive. And the chase is typically when you throw that ball, or when they're chasing after the bird, it's in pursuit of the thing. And once they do that chase, they obviously then make the strike. So the strike is the third part of prey drive, where now they've put their mouth and teeth onto that thing. So it can be, like, for example, I told my dog to down, I've walked at a distance, I mark it, and I mark it for him. It's like, hey, come get your tug. So then as he comes for the tug, he's running towards it. So he's in the chase, and then I move it quickly away from him. And he's like, whoa. So as he went to strike it, I pull away, and then he comes to chase again to go strike again, but I pull away. And then the third time, maybe I let him get it. So and also when you're telling the dog to down, especially if they're anticipating a reward, that down can be part of the stalk, right? Because a lot of dogs do lay down to stalk. So again, depending on the dog that you have. So that strike piece is that he has to come and sink his teeth into that item. Now, depending on your dog, some dogs, like a golden retriever, may not have much, like, he'll strike, he'll chase it and grab it. But a lot of times, like, and look, I'm not saying all golden retrievers, obviously, but they're not known for like playing the best tug. They really just want to grab the ball and they just want to bring it back to you so you can throw it again. Because of course, the retriever was meant to retrieve the ducks in the freezing cold lake to bring it back to the human unscathed. Like, I mean, like, bring it back to us so there's no punctures in the pheasant or in the duck, and that we can now keep it for ourselves for whatever person wants to do with it. So when people say, I can't believe it, I taught my retriever how to bring it back to me. It's like, dude, that's a predisposition. Like they're supposed to do that. Like Labradors just bring it to you all the time. Where a German Shepherd.
How to buy it.
What's that?
Like saying I taught my dog how to bite.
Yeah, I taught him how to bite, yeah. Which is funny because if we're talking to dog sports people, like
not protection like that. Is like,
yeah, you know, for sure. So many layers to all of it, right? So when the dog went to, that's right. So for example, a German Shepherd, you throw it, they'll grab it and they'll run off like away from you and they'll possess it. They love to possess it. Or like the staff, he grabs it and he won't just possess it. He'll just get to the thing and then immediately just try to destroy it. Like, I need to kill you right now. So if you think about a Jack Russell, and we've spoken about those little Jack Russells actually having the real job for ratting, is that there's not much, like they will definitely stalk, chase and strike and then fight and parade and consume like real quickly, right? Actually, in fact, I think I'm pretty sure if you're ratting, you wouldn't want your dogs to eat the rats, I'm assuming. But every dog will have that different expression. That strike can be really fun, especially when you're playing tug or when people are doing like, you know, protection sports and the dog guy's wearing the big suit, that dog is supposed to come in like and get a good grip onto that and not let go. And most of the time they won't let go. We have to teach them how to out. So that's where once the dog's onto it, teaching that drop command, teaching them to out and to leave it is really helpful and useful. However, can be hard depending on how much they're committed to it. So then you get into, while they've struck the thing, now they're going to be into the fight. So now we're playing the tug. Now there's a wrestle for the item. And again, remember, this is all about prey drive. It's a different part of the brain than aggression, where I'm sure when a dog's being aggressive, again, aggression is a defensive behavior, trying to push things away. He doesn't want to. But I'm sure once... Like I know that they don't overlap typically, but I do wonder that sometimes when a dog is in defense drive, once they start winning the fight, they may then potentially turn into prey drive and then start to go to town on you because there's a desire to do it rather than I just want this to stop so I can let the threat go away. So just like if you think about most like snipers in the army,
mm-hmm.
are typically hunters, like they're in prey drive, I'm assuming. They're not like out running around and someone throws a grenade at them and blow and bang and now we're like running around trying to like defend ourselves.
Yeah.
But then even then, there may be a moment of defense, boom, there they are. We all regroup together, boom, let's go after them, bang, back into prey. So I'm sure they can kind of ebb and flow between each other. But I'm happy
to. Yeah, I mean like, pretty sure they refer to it as stalking, right? Like a sniper, like they stalk there.
Yeah, they're like, they want it. Yeah. They want it. They're not trying to go, hey, the guys are getting too close to the base, push them back, guys. And then again, like heaps of different types of warfare, but there could be like, sometimes we seem like we're in defense, but we've just trapped them and ambushed them into our trap. So, but again, dogs aren't thinking that. Luckily, dogs don't think like that. Otherwise, we're screwed. they all conspire against us in the middle of the night. So we have the fight. The fight is when the dog's like thrashing side to side, trying to basically kill the animal, right? So even while you're in the fight, not just the strike, but now the fight of it, you want to have that control and that impulse control in your dog, and we would like them to be able to let go. Now, some dogs are just not going to let go. You have to like physically make them let go of the thing. Some dogs, like Chili the other day, or a couple months ago, were walking, and in the middle of summer, there was quite a few rats running around the beach there.
Yeah.
And he'd like hear it and he would stop and stalk. You'd see it move, boom, he would run, but he was never really quick enough. I'd always tell him to come back to me. It's like, leave it alone. And then there was one time there was like a sick rat and it was like running very slowly. And then he just like ran after it and I was just watching him. And then as the thing like jumped off the little ledge and then it saw that Chili was like within half a meter of it, it just stopped and went to freeze. And Chili just went right up to it and just stared at it.
Interesting.
And just looked at me.
Didn't touch it.
And stared at it. And he's like, so now what? You see, so he doesn't inherently have the strike fight of that part of his prey drive because that's undesirable if you have a dog that's supposed to be herding your sheep. You don't want them grabbing them and trying to kill them, right? That would be very counterintuitive. Hence why you don't see many many. I'm sure there are, so I'm not triggering nobody. But you don't see many terriers herding sheep because they'd be like, I'm going to go for its jugular. I'm going to hang off its neck, you know? So that's why in the GRC sports, it was developed for the bully breeds. So one of them is a wall climb because, you know, running up there is like physical conditioning. But the wall climb will then lead to, and then a side note to that is having like the flirt pole and the dog jumps up, grabs the tug, and I'm pretty sure the dog has to hold that tug in the air hanging for a certain amount of time to get points. And the point of that is because when a dog went up to the bull and grabbed the bull by the jugular or by the back legs or by the balls or wherever it is that the dogs would typically grab, they'd be hanging. That's the point of it. So fulfilling and giving it a close surrogate to that behavior. And when we had Jay Jack on, who was the inventor of GRC, that was a really cool, interesting podcast. Go back and listen to that one. So then you have the parade. Most people don't really know what the parade means. And you would normally see a working dog typically do this, like a shepherd or Malinois or Rottweiler, Doberman, typically, but obviously not only. So they would grab that toy, you'd play, you'd strike, you'd fight, you let them win it, so you let it go, and then they start running in a big circle. So a lot of the times that's the parade. So you want them to win it. And then if you got them on the long lead, you kind of do a bit of a circle on the spot and they run around all proud, their tail up in the air, and they're like, yes, I got the thing. And wolves and wild canids would do the same thing. They would stalk the deer. They all work together. They chase, they strike it, they fight it. Then before they consume, they run around with the meat in the air and they throw it around and they have this like game about it. I don't know. It's craziness. Mm. So you got to have a bit of fun too, right? Like it's a big win. Again, because we're so far removed from this, because most of us humans would be highly prey driven, is that it's a very, very good feeling and a very necessary feeling to feel good about getting the meat that you're about to feed yourself and your village with.
Yeah.
So when, and also when people were to hunt and then they weren't successful, they still celebrated that with ritual because it's a very important part of living. So with the dog, of course, you know, they are celebrating and having their fun with it too. Right. And you can see a lot of it when you watch like wolf documentaries, that they do that. So the parade is when your dog grabs a thing finally and runs around in the air and acts all very proud. And then of course you have the consume, which a lot of the times, as I said before, the consume part of this isn't something that we want our dogs to do when it comes to the ball or the tug, because now they've consumed an inanimate object and they get sick. And also typically the dogs don't have a need for consumption of even a real animal. If the dogs run off and kill the cat or kill the rabbit or whatever, a lot of the times they don't actually eat it because they have no need for it. They're getting fed, so they're not hungry. Maybe they don't know what to do because they've never had to do it. And certainly some dogs do eat the prey that they catch, and that just is what it is. And good luck trying to get it off them.
Dad ate a bird when he was a puppy.
There you go. Swallowed it.
Yeah.
There you go. It's gone
so fast. And he was young. He was only like...
I remember you telling me that, actually.
I reckon he was under 20 weeks old, for sure. It was during his critical period.
That's hilarious.
He was very young.
How the hell did he catch that bird?
I actually didn't see it until it was already in his mouth. I had him on the leash, but I was talking to Rach. So we were walking along the footpath. I was talking to Rach, kind of had my head facing this way. And I'm guessing it was maybe a
baby.
Baby, I don't know. Fell we didn't off, actually see it. We just saw the end result. Yeah. And it was gone.
Feathers.
Like
coming out of his mouth.
Poor little guy. Anyway.
You know? Yeah, look, if I think about it now, it's probably not true that some dogs will go through the whole six stages of prey drive when it comes like insects. Like, you know, Nookie eats insects all the time.
Mm.
So, or like the lizards and stuff.
Likes to kill flies.
Yeah, the flies, that's still part of prey drive.
He doesn't really, occasionally there'll be, you know, you'll see a cockroach every now and then. He's not interested in them, but he'll kill flies.
They're grubby ass little bugs, aren't they?
Yeah.
Actually, in fact, I just got off the phone to someone yesterday talking about their Jack Russell just like killing all the lizards Now, is that dog eating and consuming all the lizards? It's not very odd for Jack Russell to go around and clean up the whole yard. Did I talk about the guy that I met when I was doing an ultrasound? He talked about his brother-in-law with the like with all the Jack Russells in his property. And he... talk about it anyway. It's prey drive. So he moved to a property out west. That property was infested. It was like vacant for 10 years. And there was an abundance of brown snakes, red belly, black snakes, and just a whole bunch of other, like, you know, wildlife. And it was just overgrown and stuff.
Yeah.
So when he first moved in, he was clearing the land. He started living there. And he initially got like a Jack Russell, I think. And now 20 years later, he breeds them. He always has 10 working at a time. And there is not, I don't fully think this is awesome, and I wasn't excited when I heard it, but it is what it is that there was like no wildlife living on that property anymore, right?
They're doing their job.
Yeah, doing their job. However, who knows how many, you know, native animals were being killed, because it's very hard, I assume, to tell the Jack Russells, don't eat the goannas, just kill the snakes. And I'm sure there's definitely heaps of things that you can do to make that happen, but I'm talking about random guy that I don't even know has had, I don't know what he's done, but he said that they, you know, they do kill goannas and stuff too, which I'm not excited about, and also not good for the dogs, because of like a goanna can be just as...
Yeah, they go hectic, like their teeth are like little sores, aren't they? Like
little sores, and they have that bacteria that gives you like a flesh-eating disease.
Jesus.
So if you get bitten by a goanna, you're kind of screwed. Well, obviously a brown snake will kill you instantly. And he said in the last 20 years, 3 of his Jack Russells have died from snake bites.
Mm.
So 3 out of the 20
years. I think snake bites are pretty, like dog, snakes biting dogs is relatively common in the country.
100%.
Yeah, in the countryside.
But now he doesn't have.
Just environmentally, like they're everywhere.
Totally.
And the dogs are roaming and doing all kinds of stuff. So.
Yeah, definitely. Now,
I'm sure if we spoke to a countryside vet, they'd probably talk about that for sure.
Definitely. I'll tell you a story. A friend of mine back in the day, his parents were walking in Helensburg. They had two big Great Danes or Great Dane crosses.
Just for the people who don't know Helensburg, it's semi-rural, really.
Yeah. It's about like an hour and a bit south from Sydney.
Yeah.
And it's semi-rural. Where they were was like on the edge of the national park.
Yeah.
And they had their big Great Dane cross, whatever. And they actually were hunting dogs. I'm not sure how much they actually use them. One of the dogs, her name was Zoe. She wasn't that old, 7 years old, but she had some sort of like random cancer that just sprung up out of nowhere, and she was in a bad way. And then they had the other dog, the male. Anyway, and they're walking down this little hill, and there was a king brown snake. These things are like a meter and a half long, and they're probably, are they the second or the most deadliest snake in the world?
Yeah, they're either one or two, yeah.
Just so international listeners.
Google it right now. You keep talking. Google that.
International listeners, everyone thinks that Australia is like the worst for animals, and I guess there is like a lot of poisonous snakes and insects and crocodiles and sharks, but they're all up. Like crocodiles are up north, so not in Sydney. But a lot of people get freaked out. Like international people come in, they're like, oh my God, everything's like out to kill me. And I just don't think that's fully accurate. But in this story, it'll make you a bit freaked out. They're walking down this hill, and brown snakes or king brown snakes going down a hill can gain speed, something like, I'm going to make up the number, like 20 Ks an hour or something crazy.
Pretty fast, yeah.
They just go fast down the hill. So they're all four of them, mum, dad, and the two dogs were running from this brown snake chasing them. All right. So it's probably like being territorial, probably just had babies somewhere. And they're running after this thing and down a hill. And they weren't like super fit people or anything. So they were doing their best. And as I forgot the younger dog, but he was running as well. And Zoe turns around, and I'm sure this is all in defense drive, but I could be wrong. Like it was this prey drive. Where as they were running, she kind of like turns around, flanks the snake from the side, grabs its head and just like kills it on the spot. But as she kills on the spot, the thing struck her like 3 or 4 times in the face. So she ended up dying a noble death. I was actually, and this makes me sound kind of heartless, but I was happy the way that Zoe left the earth, because she was going to be euthanized. She was euthanized because she had terminal cancer.
Yeah.
And she died protecting her family. Her name's Zoe, and in Greek, Zoe is Zoe, which is life. So she gave her life for her family while they were all under the attack of this brown snake. I just thought it was kind of amazing. What a hero, right?
I'm just quickly Googling. These lists don't seem to agree on what's the... So some of the lists are saying, well, is the snake more deadly because of its aggression? So therefore, how many people it actually kills every year? Or are we talking about the poison itself? Because some snakes are very poisonous, but don't necessarily have aggression, or they don't necessarily, you know what I mean?
Well, give us a two, like from both of us.
Oh, no, there's all different ones. There's one called the saw-scaled viper, which is in Central Asia and the Middle East. But yeah, I'm just Googling the brown snake. Can induce death in less than half an hour. So yeah, it's
you're screwed.
Pretty hectic. Yeah.
You're pretty screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Snakes are dodgy. So if you're going to be out in Australian bush.
It is considered the world's, this is Wikipedia, world's second most venomous land snake after the inland taipan. Okay.
There you go. Yeah, I've heard that before too.
So if you get based, okay. So there does seem to be some kind of ranking based on its LD50 value in mice. So they obviously let them bite mice and then they measure whatever it is and then they rank them. In toxicology, the median lethal dose. Okay. So that's how they measure. Like that's how they rank the venom. So, hey, the more you know.
Heavy duty stuff. Don't want to see a snake.
No, not a brown one.
Yeah, and it's really tough because if you see one of those big ones, your natural instinct is to run, but the more you run, the more vibrations you make, the more it can identify you and chase you down.
Yeah.
If you stand still, which is so counterintuitive, then they can't really detect you, but I don't know about that. That sucks. But anyway, so in a conclusion of the six stages of prey drive and play drive, remember, most of the play that you do with your dog is stimulating from a predatory response. And something that they do for like protection sports. So if you want your dog to become, so if you're going to enter like IGP, PSA or Mondio ring, the sports where the dog has to do a high level of obedience, so usually, I know definitely an IGP, like a level of tracking, and then there's a level of protection. At first, what you want is a dog that has a high level of prey drive and has good nerves, solid nerves, that's not scared and can deal with pressure. So that dog initially sees the decoy with the sleeve and just sees a massive, huge tug toy at the end of someone's arm. That's all the dog sees. There's no aggression. There is no defensiveness. The dog's just like, oh my God, I want to bite that thing. And then you let the dog, you know, do your routine. You let the dog, you send the dog in. He goes and he stalks, he chases, he strikes, and then they go into the fight. Then the person lets go of the sleeve. The dog parades around and, yeah, there's no consume. But those are the five stages that dog gets fulfilled with. And then over time, the dog needs to be like captain, have like certain level of send the dog in. He does a bark and hold right at the decoy. He really wants to bite that thing. And depending if we give the cue, he can bite, or if the guy moves in a certain way, then the dog can bite it. Or sometimes we tell the dog to come back. So you want to have a good control of that prey drive. And then most of the time it stays within a very prey driven state until you start pushing a little bit more defensiveness in the fight. So the decoy will then put a bit more pressure onto the dog to then create a bit more of a, oh, I was trying to hunt this. Now we're in a bit of a fight. Like, oh my gosh, now we have to like deal with those feelings in amongst trying to win this situation. And then you get to a point where, depending on where you take it, again, I don't participate in these sports. I know a bit about it. So if I'm butchering it or if I'm doing it wrong and you guys are like freaking out, you know, just message me, get it off your chest.
Dashboard.
Yeah, tell me how you feel about it. We can talk more about it. But this is just in a nutshell for people that have no idea. And definitely go and search more in depth with the trainers that do this every day. So if you want a dog to become a civil dog, a dog that is working on the streets, that bites bad people and tracks missing, like a missing kind of like vigilante sort of person or whatever, not vigilante, a perpetrator. And then, they bite that person, they hold that person down until the police come and take the dog off him and lock him up. In New South Wales, I believe the law is when a dog does bite somebody that they are not allowed to out them. They're not allowed to tell the dog to let go. They have to, by law, choke the dog off. And there's a few reasons for that.
Is that a re-bite?
Yeah, if he re-grips and bites on, now we've got two sets of holes and more damage to the person. And also how much conflict will the dog be put under as well when you're trying to get them to out? So I think just the cue of, and there's so much to it, because every time you grab the dog's collar, yeah, they're going to try to bite you back through redirected aggression, or every time you grab the collar, you don't want them always to let go. So, you know, there's a complexity to that, but I thought that's a cool little side note. So if you want the dog to be civil, then what you do is now you make the dog, yeah, he has a level of prey drive. He'll hunt someone down, but now you want the dog to want to fight the person and keep them subdued until the authorities do what they need to do. Because if a dog is going to grab someone and that person's not going to just be willingly just like let it happen, he's going to kick and fight and bite and try to, you know, use a weapon on the dog or whatever. Mm. And the dog needs to be able to put up with that pressure. Where if the dog just had a level of prey drive and he's committed and he comes in and I just punch him in the head, the dog may go, oh, and then run away. And then that's not a good police dog.
See you later, yeah.
So the dog has to have a start off from prey and then move and then develop some defensiveness in it. And you would already have to have some level of desire for that. Where to my knowledge, and again, I'm happy to be wrong, is that old school protection training was making the dog defensive from the beginning. So they tie the dog up or they have the dog like, you know, tethered somewhere, and through pressure and pressure and pressure and freaking the dog out, the dog's like, hey, bah, like leave me alone, or goes to strike, and then they go, oh, and they run away. And then now the dog's reacting from a defensiveness. But the problem with that is that it's all fear-based, and you drop that leash in the middle of the fight, the dog may likely run away.
Mm-hmm.
He may not want to fight. But if he has a level of prey drive, he's like, no, I want to get him. I need him in my mouth, rather than, oh my God, this guy's freaking me out. I need him to go away. I will bite him if I had to.
He needs actual fight in him.
Yeah, you want him to like have the desire to want to catch him. Just like most MMA fighters that are going to go into the ring, they have they're predators. Like the way they look at each other and they G each other up. And yeah, they've got, it's more of fulfilling that I need to get the win here, rather than, oh my God, the guy's at my front door kicking it down. I need to get him out of here. So it's important that I want people to think about aggression and a dog biting out of aggression, or predation and a dog biting out of predation, are two different things. They can cross over and merge into each other, but playing tug with your dog doesn't make him aggressive. Punching a punching bag doesn't make you aggressive. If anything, it probably does the opposite if you can get the monkeys off your back. So I'm going to leave it there. I think that was a pretty cool episode. I thought about
it. A little bit of a technical one to mix it up.
I thought we had to do some technical, because there was a couple of borderline philosophical, psychological ones that we were talking about, and talking about the people side of it. But and I got some good feedback from Roger, one of our good listeners. And I'm like, hey man, like how we been? Because you know he's been listening to basically everything that we do, and
yeah,
give us some feedback. And you know,
we love you, so, Roger.
We love you, Roger. He says, I go on tangents and Luke brings us back to topics. So thank you, sir. and that he loves the job. Fact that, yeah, exactly, that we catch up every 2 weeks and we have our chat. It kind of gets everyone kind of being in our conversation and also like shooting the shit, which is kind of basically exactly what this is meant to be. It's not just about let me educate you so you can learn things. It's just so you can... Through conversation, we get different perspective, right?
Yeah.
But also, Luke is a good rudder and brings you back on course the topic if I stray off.
Rudder. Okay, yeah. Yes.
And sounds like you're two hanging out on the couch. Top is a good catching in 2 weeks. And there's going to be an episode that we're going to talk about. Maybe I can do it as a Q&A. I'll put it here as a bit of a teaser for the next episode. Okay. He says, what do you think about dogs becoming a luxury item? The more people are listening and their perspective of offering services, offering what owners should do, buy, feed, read, wear, supplement, etc.
Like all the outsourcing. Yeah.
All the other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially vet care and bills. I would guess that most dogs in developed countries are fed basic kibble, don't receive professional training, have adapted or learning what rules are. Curious on your thoughts. My concern is what the hell will I be paying to own a dog in 10 years? So it's cool episode, cool topic. Maybe I can save that one for maybe me and you.
Okay.
I think it's more of a conversative one rather than me like giving an answer. But yeah, I think everything's becoming more expensive. Everything's harder to get. The middle class is being destroyed. There's more richer people and, you know, more people are struggling. I hope things change. But at this stage, more dogs are being surrendered. Less dogs are being adopted. People are not sure what to do with their money. Things are getting more expensive. So not just in dogs, but with anything. Like $100 isn't $100 anymore. You tell my parents, oh, that was $100. They're like, oh my God, $100 is a lot of money when we were growing up. And now it's kind of like everything costs $100.
Yeah, $100 is nothing.
$100 is like $10 now. It's kind
$100 is a quick trip to Woolies.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, cost of living and all that has kind of compounded and made things a lot more difficult. So, yeah. But I've got a couple of guests that I've been speaking to that are going that I've lined up as well. So the next month or two is going to be exciting for us. So we'll answer that question, Roger, at some stage. And for everyone else listening, thanks for tuning in and for staying till the end. We love you all and we'll tune in for next time.
Thank you, boys and girls. See you later. Bye-bye.
Laters. Thank you for listening to another episode of Life With Your Dog. Please share with your friends if you're enjoying our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others find the show. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook, Life With Your Dog Podcast. My name's Panos, and to keep up with my dog training adventures, tips and techniques, you can find me on Instagram at np_dog_training, my website npdogtraining.com, or my YouTube channel, Nutris Pooches.
Thanks for listening, guys. My name's Luke. If you'd like to find out more about my dog training services, you can find me at www.kizuna, that's K-I-Z-U-N-A, canine.com.au. I'm also on Instagram at kizuna canine training. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.